From National Public Radio, this is Living on Earth. I'm Steve Curwood. The Environmental Protection Agency is charged with protecting the public from dangerous pesticides, but critics say the agency has fallen way behind.
It is mind-boggling to know that there are a substantial number of chemicals that have submitted data which indicates their toxicity and were just overlooked.
Under scrutiny from a suspicious public, the pesticide industry says it's changing its ways.
I think that you can see evidence of how our industry has become, quote, kinder and gentler, unquote, in terms of being more responsive to inquiries from the public.
Also, new research suggests pesticides in the food chain may play a role in promoting breast cancer. This week on Living on Earth, first this news.
I'm Jan Nunley. The trade dispute between Mexico and the United States over the killing of dolphins while fishing for tuna appears to be cooling off. From Washington, Rebecca Davis reports that the two nations have reached an informal agreement which buys them time to settle their differences.
At issue is a U.S. law known as the Marine Mammal Protection Act. Under the act, the U.S. began embargoing Mexico last year because its tuna fleets were killing too many dolphins. Mexico complained the U.S. was violating its treaty obligations under GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, by placing unfair restrictions on trade in Mexican tuna. A preliminary GATT panel agreed with Mexico, and the issue was headed to the full GATT Council for a final ruling. But Mexico now says it will defer its complaint indefinitely if U.S. officials will lobby Congress to change the dolphin protection law. The Office of the U.S. Trade Representative says no such agreement was struck with Mexico, but some environmentalists and congressional aides believe that an informal understanding was reached in which the U.S. administration would pressure lawmakers to weaken the Protection Act. However, Congress may not be an easy target, as it rejected administration attempts earlier this year to amend the law. And according to congressional sources, many in Congress still strongly oppose changing the act to accommodate countries affected by the embargo. The Marine Mammal Protection Act comes up for reauthorization again next year. For Living on Earth, I'm Rebecca Davis in Washington.
New reports that hundreds of barrels of radioactive waste were dumped into Massachusetts Bay in the 1950s have led to calls for the area to be considered as a possible Superfund site. A 1984 study by the Environmental Protection Agency said there was no danger from radiation, but evidence has been uncovered recently suggesting the EPA looked in the wrong place. Massachusetts Congressman Gary Studd says that EPA report is now useless.
The truly humbling lesson of the discoveries of the past few months is how little we do know. And that's why I think it's critical to get as independent and objective as possible an assessment at this point of exactly what happened.
Studs has asked the General Accounting Office to reconstruct dumping patterns in the bay from government records. He says at this time there's no cause for alarm about the safety of seafood caught in Massachusetts Bay. The EPA has proposed rules which will require companies to start phasing out the use of chlorofluorocarbons and three other ozone-depleting chemicals. The action is designed to fulfill the United States' commitment under an international treaty, which calls for industrialized nations to halt the production of the four chemicals completely by the year 2000. The EPA estimates the cost of seeking alternative chemicals will be $36 billion over the next 85 years, but will prevent millions of cases of skin cancer as well as avert widespread crop and wildlife damage. This is Living on Earth. Funding for a panel to establish national standards for organic food is in danger of falling through the cracks of this year's agricultural appropriations bill. $120,000, originally earmarked for the National Organic Standards Board, was stripped from a bill in the House but restored in the Senate. The 1990 Farm Act created the board and gave it until 1993 to establish standards for what food can be labeled organic. Congressional staff members say it will take a couple of years to make these rules, and it is important to get started in this fiscal year. Currently, 25 states have different standards of what can be called organic food. President Bush hiked into the Grand Canyon to defend his environmental record and to praise an agreement that should clear the air over the scenic gorge. The pact between environmentalists and the owners of a nearby coal-fired power plant will reduce sulfur dioxide emissions by 90% and eliminate a haze of smog that sometimes blankets the canyon. Bush hailed the Clean Air Pact, saying environmental goals are compatible with economic ones.
No one wants an environmental policy that permits the wanton destruction of our national treasures, nor can we afford a policy that makes the American worker an endangered species. Our policy should promote economic growth, create new jobs, and still let everyone enjoy the grandeur of the outdoors. And believe me, it can be done. It is being done.
Some environmentalists and opposition Democrats used the occasion to charge that Bush has done little to deliver on his promise of becoming the environmental president. The Bush administration has adopted rules which ban imports of fish caught by drift nets. The Commerce Department will require that France, Japan, Taiwan, and Korea certify that none of the fish they export to the United States were caught in the nets. The rules, which go into effect next July, allow fish caught in nets less than a mile and a half long to be labeled dolphin safe. That's this week's news. I'm Jan Nunley.
This is Living on Earth. I'm Steve Curwood. After nearly 20 years of controversy, the Environmental Protection Agency has announced that it will ban the widely used pesticide ethyl parathion. Used on everything from almond and peach trees to corn and soybeans, parathion appears to pose no threat to consumers, but it has caused the deaths of nearly 100 farm workers in the United States alone. The parathion controversy and charges that the EPA has let reports of other dangerous farm chemicals languish without action have raised new questions about the agency's two-decade-old pesticide regulation program. From Washington, Ann Goodwin Sides has our report.
In 1972, Congress gave the newly founded EPA 3 years to evaluate the safety of all pesticides used on American farms. But 16 years later, not one of the basic 600 pesticide compounds that were on the market had been evaluated. So in 1988, Congress set up the Pesticide Re-Registration Program, a series of deadlines to be completed by November 1997. Unfortunately, the EPA is already behind schedule. Earlier this month, the agency finally took action on one of the most notorious pesticides on their list, ethyl parathion. The EPA announced an almost immediate ban on many of the chemical's uses and a total phase-out over 18 months. EPA officials admit that the agency knew about the dangers of parathion for years and could have pulled it off the market long ago. But Linda Fisher, the EPA's top pesticide regulator, says that until the EPA could determine there were safe alternatives, the agency stopped short of a ban.
When it came on the market, people knew it was toxic to workers. And over the years, a number of actions have been taken to try to protect workers. More protective clothing has been required, longer intervals between the time it's applied and the time people could go back into the field. What has happened of late that allowed us to make the decision to take it off the market is the fact that there are safer substitutes that farmers can use now.
Environmental and farm worker groups argue that a pesticide as dangerous as parathion should have been yanked off the market 20 years ago. Instead, they say, parathion was put in a holding pattern that typifies the EPA's approach to pesticide regulation, painstakingly weighing the benefits against the risks, giving too much weight to economic considerations, and ignoring non-chemical pest management alternatives. Critics are further disappointed that once the EPA tagged parathion for cancellation, it took still more time negotiating an agreement with the manufacturer that will keep the pesticide on the market until the middle of 1993. But Linda Fisher says that suddenly pulling a chemical like parathion from farms and distributors across the country means courting even greater dangers in transporting and disposing of existing stocks.
It may be easier and even safer generally to just have farmers go ahead and use the supply they have rather than try to recall the stocks all the way up through the line.
Despite its voluntary compliance so far, the pesticide industry maintains that parathion is dangerous only if improperly handled and says it intends to fight the EPA to hang on to whatever restricted uses of parathion it can. But Jay Vroom, president of the National Agricultural Chemicals Association, says this doesn't mean the industry is trying to resist regulation or disregard public concern.
I think that you can see evidence of how our industry has become, quote, kinder and gentler, unquote, in terms of taking into consideration its public image and being more responsive to inquiries from the public who legitimately have the right to ask questions about not only the efficacy and the necessity of our products, but also their use and safety, impact on farm workers, and ultimately on all of us as food consumers.
Vroom says the pesticide industry has cooperated with the EPA in submitting research on a range of possible health effects from pesticides, including cancer, birth defects, and genetic damage. But the EPA has been buried in data, some of it incomplete or even falsified by fraudulent laboratories. And in trying to prioritize its workload, the agency is usually focused on studies indicating consumer risk, while hundreds of other reports on chemicals that may pose risks to workers or to the environment are shelved, sometimes for years.
It is mind-boggling to know that there are a substantial number of chemicals that have submitted data which indicates their toxicity and should have been flagged for immediate action and were just overlooked.
Congressman George Brown is a Democrat from California and a member of the House Agriculture Committee. He says one such chemical was abruptly brought to the EPA's attention this summer when a derailed freight train spilled 19,000 gallons of the fungicide methamsodium into California's Sacramento River, killing all aquatic life for 45 miles downstream. Weeks later, California officials discovered two unread reports to the EPA describing severe spinal and brain birth defects in laboratory animals exposed to methamsodium. Linda Fisher of the EPA says methamsodium is now on a fast-track review, and the EPA is trying to develop a better priority system so that studies like these will be reviewed much more quickly in the future. Congressman Brown is skeptical. He says the EPA's pesticide program is a low priority for the Bush administration, but he blames Congress, too, for not exercising its oversight of the EPA and for being reluctant to take action which could hurt the chemical and agricultural industries, both of which are well represented in Congress.
I don't think the Congress is doing enough. However, a few more stories indicating the serious problems here always tends to increase the priority level.
Brown says that in the aftermath of the methamsodium and parathion cases, Congress may increase the fee pesticide manufacturers must pay the EPA when submitting a chemical for review. This would allow the agency to hire more scientists and could expedite the re-registration process in the future. For Living on Earth, this is Anne Goodwin Sides in Washington.
A basic question posed by the pesticide controversies is the safety of the food supply. Do present government rules and practices assure that people aren't hurt by chemicals intended to poison pests? Recently, the National Academy of Sciences began a comprehensive review of the effects of toxins, including agricultural chemicals, on children, and the results of that are expected in a few months. We spoke with Susan Cooper of the National Coalition Against the Misuse of Pesticides and Jay Vroom of the National Agricultural Chemical Association about the question of food safety.
The safety of our food supply is of the utmost concern to the crop protection industry, and we believe that the current regulatory system that is in place is very effective. They assure the safety of our food supply with regard to pesticide residues.
I'd just like to comment on that for a minute. Of the 671 pesticides that were registered, that are currently under re-registration, they were registered before the new health and safety standards were put into place. The re-registration process began in 1972. In 19 years, the EPA has managed to fully assess the data and get all of the important studies on only 7 of those 671 pesticides. The remainder, some 660-odd pesticides, do not have complete health and safety data. So to go forward with the assumption that we have all the information we need on these chemicals is simply unfounded.
Mr. Vroom?
Well, Steve, Susan's point is in part correct. We need to get about the business of continuing to put more pesticides on the officially stamped re-registration list. But her point may tend to confuse your listeners by ignoring the fact that there have been hundreds of case study reviews of individual pesticides and specific health and environmental impact assessments that have been going on continuously and will continue to go on, even on pesticides that get that official re-registration stamp of approval. The EPA has not been sitting back and ignoring the ongoing considerations that come to light from time to time, many, most of which are brought forward voluntarily by the companies that are the registrants of the pesticides that are in question here.
Let me move ahead to another subject area, if I might. The National Academy of Sciences, at the request of the Congress, is conducting this comprehensive review of toxic substances in children, and one of the areas is pesticides. Are federal regulations regarding pesticides designed to take the differences of children in mind or not?
No, they're not. In general, EPA regulation with regard to food residue focuses on the average risk to the average American and read adult white male when you read average American. And they rarely make regulation on the basis of a single particular subgroup at risk. Children are, in general, more susceptible to the effects of toxic substances than are adults in the majority of cases. That is true for a number of reasons. The first one is for their body weight and size, they breathe more air and they eat more food. In addition, their eating habits are slightly different to those of adults. Their neurological systems are also more vulnerable.
Now, are there studies that show these kind of things happening in children?
Yes, indeed. There are a great many studies. For example, one study done about 3 years ago indicated that children whose parents used pesticides in the home or garden had about a 6.5-fold increased rate of leukemia. That has been confirmed by a number of other studies showing a correlation between parents or children's exposure to pesticides and various forms of blood dyscrasia, aplastic anemia, and different types of leukemia.
This is pretty serious stuff that children are affected by pesticides in ways more than adults. Mr. Vroom?
Well, Steve, I would suggest that the studies that Susan cited have not been widely accepted or broadly peer-reviewed throughout the scientific community. The statistics, again, on a macro perspective, show us that children generally are healthier now than they were when you and I were growing up, I'm sure, and that particular trend line is likely to continue, but it will continue only if we take a very serious attitude about all of these questions and allegations about the use of my industry's products to help grow safer, more abundant food, industrial pollution, and all manner of things that affect our lives.
Jay Vroom is president of the National Agricultural Chemical Association, and Susan Cooper is a staff ecologist for the National Coalition Against the Misuse of Pesticides.
Some pesticides are known to cause cancer in animals, but the question of whether they are carcinogenic in humans remains largely unanswered. Recently, some scientists have begun looking at the possible role of pesticides in breast cancer, a disease that kills more than 40,000 women in the United States each year. More than half of all cases of breast cancer can't be accounted for by known risk factors, such as family history or late first pregnancy. And scientists are becoming convinced that environmental factors must also play a role. Tatiana Schreiber reports on new research that suggests pesticides in the food chain may play a part in promoting human breast cancer.
Evidence that there may be a link between breast cancer and pesticides comes from research by two Israelis published last year by the New York Academy of Sciences. Doctors Jerry Weston and Elihu Richter of Hebrew University's Hadassah School of Medicine were intrigued by a drop in breast cancer mortality at a time when all the assumed risk factors for Israeli women were worsening. Given international trends and an already high rate of breast cancer in Israel, the two men assumed they'd see a continued rise in cancer deaths in the decade between 1976 and 86.
What we found was that there was an 8% drop, and in the youngest age groups, the drop was 34%, and as opposed to an expected 20% rise. So we're talking, if we put those two figures together, of a difference of something like 50%, which is enormous.
Dr. Weston says the drop can't be accounted for by demographic changes or improved medical intervention. He and Richter say what they have learned is that until 1978, Israeli milk and all milk products were heavily contaminated with three pesticides used in dairy production. In fact, these organochlorine pesticides, including lindane and DDT, were found in Israeli milk at levels of 100 to 1,000 times greater than in the United States during the same periods.
And suddenly they were banned from the milk shed in 1978, and within 6 to 8 months they disappeared virtually from milk products. And so that there was a nationwide, very dramatic change in exposure to carcinogens. And we thought that perhaps there might be a connection between this decrease in exposure and the decrease in breast cancer mortality.
Weston says the data, which looks at breast cancer rates and pesticide residues in a large population, doesn't necessarily prove that the chemicals play a role. But he says other scientists have yet to come up with another interpretation for the Israeli results. What's needed, scientists say, are studies that directly measure chemical residues in women who have breast cancer compared with those who don't. One researcher who has done just this is Dr. Mary Wolf, a chemist at New York's Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Wolf recently completed a pilot study with Dr. Frank Falk at Hartford Hospital in Connecticut. Their report will be published later this year in the Archives of Environmental Health. She used techniques developed over years of studying how the body stores chemicals to measure pesticide residues in breast fat.
This was a case control study of a small number of women in which we measured a number of pesticide residues and found that some of them were elevated in cases with malignant compared with non-malignant disease.
The study involved 25 women with breast cancer and an equal number who had biopsies but didn't have cancer. The results showed differences significant enough to interest the government's National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences, which will fund a larger study, a collaboration between Wolf at Mount Sinai and Dr. Paolo Toniolo, an epidemiologist at New York University's School of Medicine. Wolf and Toniolo will be looking at DDE, which is a metabolite of the pesticide DDT, and PCBs, a common industrial chemical, both in the organochlorine class of chemicals. They were found at higher levels among the women with breast cancer in the pilot study and are widely dispersed in the environment. The organochlorine pesticides, like DDT, were widely used in the United States from the 1940s through the 1970s. Though still used in the Third World, most have been banned in this country because of their high toxicity and evidence that they're carcinogenic in animals. They tend to accumulate in the food chain and concentrate in animal fat and milk. Mary Wolf.
They're stored in fat and stay around, some of them, we think, for a person's lifetime. PCBs and DDT, if they have a role in carcinogenesis, are thought to be promoters. That is, that they will take an initiating event and carry it along the road to cancer. That could happen a number of ways.
Wolf says DDT and its metabolites are estrogenic. That is, they could act like estrogen is thought to in promoting tumor growth. The organochlorines also affect an important system of enzymes in the body. The Israeli investigators think these changes could promote tumor growth itself, or deactivate the immune system, or destroy anti-cancer medications. The fact that levels of pesticide residues found in human adipose tissue in the United States has been decreasing since the 1970s, while the breast cancer rate continues to rise, seems to contradict the Israeli observations. But New York University's Paolo Toniolo points out that the chemicals could act differently at different exposure levels, and they're unlikely to act alone.
It's probably a complex interactions, if you allow me, between chemicals in the environment, endogenous hormones, dietary factors that all concurrently act in a very complex way and ultimately will lead to a malignant transformation and tumor.
Toniolo adds that process could take 20 to 30 years, and age at exposure to chemicals in the environment is probably important. He also emphasizes that different individuals may be more or less predisposed to developing cancer. In the new study, Toniolo will add pesticide exposure to factors he's examining in ongoing research involving 15,000 women attending a breast cancer screening clinic in New York. Toniolo Wolf and the Israeli scientists are among the first to look at a possible link between breast cancer and pesticides. The subject has yet to generate wider interest for several reasons.
First, these chemicals occur in rather low levels in the bodies of most individuals in the population. And second, these chemicals are not thought to be highly carcinogenic.
Dr. Walter Willett is a nutritional epidemiologist at the Harvard School of Public Health.
Nevertheless, they can interfere with normal physiology at certain levels. And since we understand the development of breast cancer so poorly, I think we should not exclude the possibility that they might not have some influence on the basis of our hypotheses.
Willett has been at the forefront of breast cancer research as one of the principal investigators of Harvard's Nurses' Health study, which followed some 120,000 women over 15 years. There's conflicting evidence about breast cancer risk factors, and Willett doesn't think dietary fat is all that important. Toniolo, on the other hand, conducted research in Italy that found a positive association between the consumption of high-fat dairy products and the incidence of breast cancer. He believes it's possible that people taking in more dairy fat are taking in more chemicals at the same time. And once concentrated in breast tissue, these chemicals could promote tumor growth. Evidence that women who have breastfed have a somewhat lower risk for breast cancer would support this theory, since these women may have expelled their own pesticide stores while passing them on to their children. But researchers emphasize the benefits of breastfeeding seem to outweigh any potential risk to infants from stored pesticides. Willett says, though he and Toniolo seem to approach the issue from opposite directions, they arrive at a similar conclusion.
I think we should be interested in these kinds of chemicals simply because they are non-natural chemicals that have been incorporated into our bodies over the last several decades. And here we're looking at a disease, breast cancer, which we don't really understand, which has been increasing steadily over the last 40 or 50 years. And again, we really should keep our minds quite open, pursue every possible lead, because the importance is staggering, and we don't have a way at this point in time to prevent this disease.
Given the small sample in Wolf's pilot study and the conflicting nature of current hypotheses about the possible role of pesticides in breast cancer, more research is essential in order to see if there is a clear-cut link. Wolf and Toniolo's new study will measure chemical residues in blood samples in a large population of women, and it takes into consideration reproductive factors, dietary habits, family history of cancer, and levels of hormones in the body. Results should be available in about a year. Though these efforts may be too late for many women who already have cancer, they promise to shed new light on this devastating and still little understood disease. For Living on Earth, I'm Tatiana Schreiber.
And for this week, that's Living on Earth. Our editors are Peter Thompson and George Holmesy. Living on Earth is produced in cooperation with the Public Media Foundation and WBUR Boston. Our theme music was composed by Michael Aaron. I'm Steve Kerwood, executive producer. If you'd like to write us, our address is Living on Earth, Box 639, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 02238.
Major funding for Living on Earth comes from the W. Alton Jones Foundation, with additional support from the Public Welfare Foundation and the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.